Death of Joe Egg, one of the finest plays I think ever written, on its first production in London. There have been two productions, and a more recent one. Did that have the same producer, and did they each have the same producer and same director?
Which, the first and what?
And the second production, more recent one. And Eddie Izzard was in the second one at some time.
Yeah, Clive Owen was in that one earlier than Eddie, and Clive broke his contract and went out to do a film.
Yes.
He's now become a big film star. And so that Eddie was then hanging around, luckily for us, and he came in and played the part. They were totally different productions. Totally different.
It might have been a different play that I saw the second time.
No, the play was more or less the same. Joe Egg.
The words were the same. On the page, it was the same.
More or less. Yeah, Joe Egg is the one play of mine, I think, that I don't much tamper with. Because I have nothing more to say on that subject, really. You know, and people sometimes say to me, you know, can you talk about the difficulty of being disabled, or, you know, how to bring up a handicapped child? And I say, it isn't really about that. It's about how far you can go with humour. That is my view of the play. It's how far you, at that time, you could go without being gratuitously insulting or offensive, and just say, you know, look, laugh at this too. The comedian Bernard Manning once said he would make jokes about, because he was very offensive, racist and everything else, but he said, there's two things I wouldn't make jokes about, the royal family and handicapped kiddies. And I thought that was the most perfect example of a horrible Philistine soppy attitude towards humour.
Yes.
And so my thing was really to make a joke about an impermissible subject.
No, that was not quite my question. I'm talking about what I felt was the difference between the two productions.
Mm-hmm.
Did Michael Codron present both productions?
No, he didn't present either.
Oh.
So Michael Codron was... I think Alex said warned off it by my agent.
Uh-huh.
It was actually brought in by Albert Finney. He was the producer. The director was Michael Blakemore,
yes,
who only directed the first production.
Ah, yes.
And that had Joe Melia and Zena Walker.
Indeed, yes.
In
thank
it.
You.
And they
Joan
were.
Joan Hickson.
Joan Hickson.
Yes.
And they were, in my opinion, the definitive cast, and that was the definitive
absolutely
production.
Absolutely definitive.
I don't think it's ever been done better.
Second time round, putting a stand-up comedian, brilliant though he may be, and I saw it and sat through it. Friends of mine saw it, walked out. Is this putting bums on seats?
Well,
Eddie, great man.
I'd seen Eddie doing Lenny, about Lenny Bruce, the comedian,
yeah,
and thought he was a brilliant actor, and still do think he's a brilliant actor.
You do.
He hasn't got... I think he needed a director who... In fact, the one we had wasn't strong enough to tell him that there's a difference between appearing as yourself as a stand-up comedian
and
making jokes that come out from your own personality and immersing yourself into a character. Because Eddie would turn to the audience and start to do a five-minute shtick, you know, on one line in the play, leaving the poor actress
Well, this was my point.
Yeah.
That
oh, you saw him do that, probably.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And it's horror. And, you know, let's get out of here. Let's leave.
Well, right. I did write to him and say, I did give him a strong note that you can't just go out of a play and start to do your thing as Eddie Izzard. If you're going to be a character, you've got to be Brian in that play, in that situation. It's an interesting point.
Interesting question around improvisation, because improvisation is written into the play originally, but that was taking an extra stage, I think. Any other questions? One at the back.
Thank you, Philip Headley. Peter, you mentioned three other playwrights, apart from you, who went through the repertory system and went through acting, and I'd add Henry Livings to that list as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's very there's a slim volume to be written about playwrights who came out of the rep system, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And what they gained from that experience as actors in that particular system, what they gained and what they took and what they fought against in that particular system.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting that young... I can't think of young playwrights today who have gone through acting to the extent that writers of your generation went through acting, and particularly that acting where you, in rep, you played very different parts.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, could you talk a little more about what you think you gained from that acting experience in that system and what you perhaps rebelled against?
Well, as you know, I don't know that you know the logistics of weekly rep, but you started rehearsing Tuesday morning because on Monday you'd open the last play. On Tuesday morning, you read what was usually a three-act play in those days. So you read Act One, and set the words and everything, and then you read the whole play, and then you went home and started working on Act One. You did that on Tuesday. On Wednesday, you did Act Two, and Thursday, you did Act Three, and on Friday, you ran the whole thing, and on Saturday, you had the first real run, so that you appeared on Monday night, from a dress rehearsal on Sunday or Monday morning. I mean, you were just sort of muddling through these plays, really paraphrasing them. And I guess it was good that they weren't very good plays, usually. They were only conventional West End, usually West End, thrillers, farces, comedies, etc. There was no room for any investigation of the play. There was no room for any discussion or going into the characters in depth. You just had to do what was there on the page and more or less get through it. I mean, it's astonishing that anything did get on at all. But in some cases, I think they did do more ambitious plays. How, I imagine, I really can't imagine. Then you graduated, if you were lucky, to fortnightly rep, which was considered, wow, the middle class. You know. And then you went into, if you were luckier still, you went into the Bristol Old Vic or the Birmingham Rep, where you did three weekly and even monthly plays. But this wasn't weekly rep. We're getting on now to an entirely different thing where all those companies were run by the Arts Council. Whereas the weekly rep productions were usually very low commercial standard, low profits. You know? I mean, it was just a place where you could go and get a job and walk on the stage and feel, get a sense of the audience. And I think probably we did learn a good deal about the bricks and mortar of the theatre, you know, the ordinary, the way it worked, the way an audience laughed or didn't laugh, the way you held back and did certain things. I don't know. It's very, very difficult for me to say. One, because it's a long time ago, and two, because I'd already had a certain amount of experience being in the Forces Entertainment world with Stanley Baxter, Kenneth Williams, John Schlesinger. So I wasn't an entire novice.
A gloriously rich subject matter, though, isn't it? The people, the characters, the incidents reoccur in some of your plays, some of Harold Pinter's plays, and also some of the formal qualities.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose I could say that I came out from the naturalism of those plays. Most of them were, I mean, you know, the curtain rose and there was a room, basically. There was a room of some kind, you know, usually a middle-class room with French windows. It was as bad as that. It was as predictable as that. Anything, any slight variation from that was regarded as avant-garde, you know, practically. Speaking to the audience was completely out. Nobody ever did it. Nobody ever addressed the audience directly. And it was here that I began to see, and I suppose it had gone into me somewhere or other, that... why don't we break this naturalism? You know, why don't we say, hey, look, you know, we don't need to always stay behind this invisible glass wall of the proscenium. Why don't we sometimes talk directly through it? And that's what led, in a way, to my thinking about Joe Egg.
Any more questions? We've probably got time for one more.
Got one there.
Yes, thanks very much for Joe Egg. Is that okay? The single most important theatrical experience of my life, and many marvellous experiences in the 40 years since for me, Born in the Gardens most recently at Bath, which I thought was wonderful. you can't see where the set ends and the theatre begins at Bath, can you? But
right.
when they do it at Kingston Theatre next month, you will be able to see where the set ends and the theatre begins, won't you?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Which do you prefer? A modern theatre?
It's a question that, you know, the jury's still out as far as I'm concerned. I loved working at Greenwich. I was on the board of the Greenwich Theatre when it started, and I loved that semi-thrust stage of Greenwich, and I wrote Forget Me Not Lane for that stage, because what it was is it was a three-sided thrust, so I wrote screens that went back the same shape so that it became a six-sided, became a hexagonal platform. And I loved that theatre. I think it was very, and I'd worked on, last year they did Forget Me Not Lane at Scarborough, which, as you know, is completely in the round. And I've worked in Minneapolis in the Guthrie Theatre, which is a semi-thrust. And they all present different difficulties. And they're none of them perfect. I suppose I am instinctively, perhaps because I was an actor in rep, wedded to the proscenium, essentially. I still think it's a shame that when you go in, you see the set. I've got this idea of almost a sort of striptease idea, you know, that the curtain should be down and then it rises like a skirt and reveals this surprise, whatever it's going to be. You know, as it is, you go in and you sit there and, you know, well, you know what the set is before we start. Whereas I like the idea of you actually unveiling the set, unveiling the whole box of tricks. We broke that rather cleverly, I think, with the National Health, where the audience came in to find the hospital ward, and half an hour before the play began, the actors were already in their beds as patients, and the nurses were crossing and checking their beds and all that sort of thing, occasional talking, you know, and all that sort of thing. So that by the time the play started, half an hour later, you were very into the atmosphere of the play. But that was a conscious break. But now it seems it's the theatre architecture and lighting particularly have changed so much that, you know, it's no longer possible to have tabs down and go up, which I think in a sense is a shame.
Okay. Very reluctantly, I think we're going to have to draw proceedings to a close there. Can we just thank Peter and Alec for their contributions?
Thank you.